Hi, Marco here. January will be here before we know it, and that means time is running short to make your gift before our fundraiser ends on December 31st. A sincere thank you to everyone who has already donated to our nonprofit newsroom this year. It truly means a lot. Your gift helps ensure that we are able to continue this crucial work. And if you haven't donated yet, now is the time. We need you. Your donation goes far beyond dollars and cents. It validates the importance of our work and enables us to tell the stories that matter to listeners like you. You're not only helping our newsroom flourish, you're also paying it forward for your fellow listeners who are not in a position to donate right now. Please make your gift today to sustain our nonprofit newsroom. You can head to theworld.org/give to donate and learn more. That's theworld.org/give. Thank you so much. Increasing rampant violence in the streets of Haiti makes routines of daily life hazardous. But even in their own homes, people are not safe.
At the moment, there is no school, so the kids are basically on house arrest. And even when you are at home, you are not secure.
I'm Marco Werman. Also today, the last words of a Palestinian poet killed in Gaza are inspiring others to write and to carry on.
His poem, If I Must Die, that this is our mission, that we have to continue. We have to complete his mission.
And we remember South African playwright Mogani Ngama, whose work imagined a world without apartheid.
I began to see young children in school uniform running and singing, and the song that came to my mind was Freedom is coming tomorrow.
Ngama's musical Serafina took that message to Broadway and beyond. All that and more today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Thank you for making it here today. In Washington, the Biden administration announced on Wednesday that it's sending another military aid package to Ukraine. $250 million is the last tranche of money that the U.S. can send to Ukraine without Congress passing a new spending bill. A $61 billion military aid package, meantime, has stalled in Congress. In Kyiv, top Ukrainian officials held two major end-of-year press conferences that look ahead to the war effort in 2024. For more on that, we're joined by The World's Daniel Offman from Riga, Latvia. It seems, Daniel, something has changed about the way Ukraine's top officials are talking about the war and what they're expecting in the coming year. What did you hear in these press conferences?
Well, Marco, they're being more blunt and more realistic kind of about where Ukraine stands in its war effort. So just to compare, last year, President Volodymyr Zelensky, Ukraine's president, said that 2023 was going to be a year of victory. So he's not making sweeping statements like that this time around. But one of the biggest topics that's being talked about right now in Ukraine is mobilization. So last week, Zelensky commented on this during his end-of-year press conference. Here's what he said.
Mobilizovati dodatkovych 450-500,000 людей.
He's saying here that the military proposed a plan to mobilize an additional 450,000 to 500,000 people. He also said that he didn't approve anything yet, and he wants to hear a little bit more from the general staff. But that just shows you Zelensky isn't talking about a year of victory. He's talking about the resources and troops that his country needs to keep the fight going.
Interesting. So that's what Zelensky had to say. What are the top ranks of Ukraine's military saying?
So just earlier this week, in a rare press conference, we heard from General Valery Zaluzhny. He's the commander-in-chief of Ukraine's military. And he wasn't specific about the numbers, but he basically confirmed what Zelensky said, that Ukraine will need to mobilize more troops. He also spoke a little more generally about Ukraine's war effort in this coming year. So he's saying here that 2024 will be different. It needs to be different than 2023. He said that Ukraine will continue developing its technology and its weapons, but he also warned that Russia isn't far behind and that both sides are adapting to each other. So the bottom line for Zaluzhny is that the Ukrainian military needs more of everything in order to gain an edge on Russia.
Right, and back to the resources question, does Ukraine have the resources for that kind of investment?
Well, to a large degree, Ukraine really depends on outside funding, especially from the U.S. and the EU. And as of now, that funding has stalled, so Ukraine really wouldn't be able to ramp up its military production, for example, without that support. And Ukraine doesn't rely on that outside help just for its military. It also relies on that money in order to keep the country going. So just yesterday, Ukraine's Deputy Prime Minister Yulia Sviridenko warned that if Ukraine doesn't receive this financial support by early in the new year, it won't be able to pay millions of pensions and public servants.
That's a really worrying bottom line. I'm wondering, Daniel, how that could affect how Ukrainians view the war effort. Like, how confident are Ukrainians in their leadership these days going into the new year?
According to a few recent polls, Zelensky's trust rating is at 62%. Another poll had him in the 70s. But the key in Ukraine is how these numbers compare to last year. So last year, his approval rating was at 84%. And there are few explanations for why his rating has dipped. So over the last year, some of Zelensky's political opponents have been a lot more critical of Zelensky's leadership. There's also war fatigue in Ukraine, and the idea of mobilization is unpopular. But overall, Ukraine's public trust in their leadership throughout this war really depends on what happens on the battlefield.
Yeah, and so to that end, Daniel, are there any major recent developments from the battlefield in Ukraine that might affect public opinion, either positively or negatively?
So overall, most of the front line is pretty stable. Last month, General Zaluzhny famously said that the war right now is at a stalemate. But at the same time, there have been some developments. Russia has gained some ground in eastern Ukraine, but Ukraine has also pushed back. So on Monday, Ukraine's military said that it shot down 5 Russian fighter jets in just 3 days. And on Tuesday, Ukrainian officials said that they destroyed another Russian warship in the Black Sea. So although the front line hasn't moved much of late, the conflict isn't completely frozen. So Ukrainians just hope that the military aid from abroad doesn't dry up in 2024.
The World's Daniel Hoffman joining us from his base in Riga, Latvia. Daniel, will continue to follow this conflict into 2024 with hopes for peace. As always, thank you for your insights.
Thanks, Marco.
In Haiti, as we look to the final days of the year, there is no improvement there in the wave of violent crime, which means daily life continues to be challenging for ordinary Haitians. More tragedy this month. The week before Christmas, at least 5 people were killed by gangs. On Christmas Day, 2 10-year-old girls were murdered, while 4 of their family members were kidnapped. We have more from the world's TBC Isaiah.
In Haiti, gang violence is out of control. This year alone, at least 4,000 people were murdered and 3,000 more were kidnapped by gangs, according to the United Nations. Velina Charlier is a resident of Port-au-Prince, the capital.
It's hell in Haiti. We are only surviving. I have 4 daughters. My eldest is 13 and my youngest is 5 months old. And we encounter the gang violence daily. I mean, everybody who lives in Haiti, you face gang violence and you face the risk of being kidnapped.
She says residents are forced to pay a toll to the gangs to go between neighborhoods and that people frequently see dead bodies lying on the streets. The week before Christmas, there was a series of violent attacks in Port-au-Prince, where 80% of the territory is controlled by gangs. And they are expanding to the countryside, too. A recent report by the UN says heavily armed men are fighting rival gangs in rural areas, killing farmers and raping women and children.
At the moment, there is no school. So the kids are basically on house arrest. And even when you are at home, you are not secure because we have had many occurrences where gang get into people's house to kidnap them.
This past fall, the United Nations approved a multinational intervention in Haiti led by Kenya, which is set to start in early 2024. 1,000 Kenyan police officers are expected to be deployed in Port-au-Prince to assist the Haiti National Police. Renata Segura is with International Crisis Group, and she says it's not surprising that there has been an uptick in violence ahead of this intervention.
The gangs are trying to consolidate territory. They are fighting each other and the Haitian police so that when the mission arrives, they can either negotiate from a position of strength or they are well placed to combat the foreign troops.
The security intervention was approved by Kenya's parliament, but is facing legal challenges brought by the opposition. Kenya's high court is expected to make a decision in January. Segura is optimistic.
In the next few weeks, we should be seeing at least an initial deployment of some troops, with a larger deployment following soon after.
The prospect of an international intervention has brought hope to many Haitians, says Louis-Henri Mars. He's the director of the Peace Institute La Coulapé in Port-au-Prince.
Anything that has to happen here in this country in terms of turning it around has to start with degrading the power of the armed groups here in Haiti. There has to be some force that is a threat to them and that they respect.
Violent crime in Haiti increased dramatically after President Jovenel Moïse was assassinated in July of 2021. The power vacuum crippled the Haitian state, and gangs took advantage of this to expand their territorial control. Renata Segura with the International Crisis Group says solving the mystery of who was behind the assassination of the president is key to start curbing the violence.
There is this sense of injustice and lack of clarity behind this assassination, and that really creates a lot of insecurity that this can happen, that men can come into the president's house and assassinate him in the middle of the night. I think everybody understands the really dramatic consequences of this level of impunity happening.
So far this year, close to 200,000 Haitians have been detained at the U.S.-Mexico border or by the U.S. Coast Guard. Another 100,000 have arrived using the new humanitarian parole program. And a growing number are moving across the island of Hispaniola to the Dominican Republic, where they face the constant risk of being deported back to Haiti. For The World, I'm Tivisa Isaiah.
Musician Pilani Bubu is a talented and creative force in her home of South Africa. Her songs embrace the richness and diversity of her country's many styles. The World's April Peavy first introduced us to Bubu earlier this year.
Pilani Bubu admits she comes from a family of privilege, jumping off the shoulders of giants, she says. A family that encouraged education and creativity.
I studied law and I studied marketing, and then I went into the creative space and realized actually my best medium to communicate and to make any change is to use my best gifts, which was music.
Pilani Bubu was born in 1984 during the last decade of apartheid, in the area now known as Eastern Cape, home to the Xhosa people. As a child of the MTV generation, she straddled the two worlds of globalization and tradition, the traditions of her homeland. But to really understand her heritage, she first had to leave South Africa. In 2012, she left her job in the corporate world and
packed my bags to go to the New Orleans Jazz Fest with, like, my CDs, my demo CD, Journey of a Heart. And I was supposed to stay 5 days during the Jazz Fest, and I stayed 3 months.
Bubu found her music community in the Big Easy, but the people she met there wanted to learn more about her.
And I started including repertoire of music from South Africa, because when you travel in the world, people will look at you as an African girl, an African child, and try to understand a story about your people and your life. And it helped me dig a little bit deeper, and I realized, wow, there was like a wealth of stuff sitting with me that I could share. Let's tune into Kongo Twane, which is a traditional folk song. And so that's one that I leaned into, reinterpreting it for today. I mean, a lot of the work that I do really is posed to the next generation who, like me, took a lot of our culture for granted. So looking back into traditional folk songs.
This is just one example of the indigenous folk music Bubu records. It's off her album Folklore Chapter 1. Songs of spirit animals, respect for ancestors, and the role of women, too. Topics important to Pilani Bubu.
The World's April Peavy with a profile there of Pilani Bubu, The singer-songwriter released a new album this year called Folklore Chapter 2. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Egypt Today said that it has put forward a proposal to end the current Israel-Hamas conflict. It includes steps toward a ceasefire, and Cairo is waiting for a response from all the parties. Israel's continued bombardment of Gaza has killed more than 21,000 people, according to the Hamas-run health ministry in Gaza. Earlier this month, one of the victims was Palestinian poet and academic Refaat Alarir. In the weeks before he was killed, Alarir shared on social media a poem he wrote entitled If I Must Die. The actor, Brian Cox, known for his role as the patriarch in the series Succession, is one of more than 300 artists who have publicly called for a ceasefire. This is Cox reading part of that poem.
If I must die, you must live to tell my story, to sell my things, to buy a piece of cloth and some strings.
It ends with Alarir's words, let his loss bring hope and a story that lives on. As the world's Duri Biskaran reports, many people in Gaza are leaving all kinds of messages of their own.
23-year-old Noor Nemed used to be afraid to write.
I've always felt like writing would make me vulnerable.
When Nemed took Refaat Alarir's classes at the Islamic University of Gaza, she says her teacher, who she and fellow students called Dr. Refaat, gave her strength.
Actually, Dr. Refaat is the one who taught us to be literally free, like completely free, internally free, to stand for what we believe in, even if he himself doesn't like what we believe in, to question what we believe in.
Nemed is now safe, living in Turkey with her family. Many of her classmates are still in Gaza, including Haya El-Rafai, who called Dr. Refaat the soul of the university, in a text message read here.
He taught us not to underestimate our value. He pushed me to believe in myself, my abilities, and my points of view.
Another student at the Islamic University, 21-year-old Khalid Al-Hissi, remembers how Dr. Refaat spent an entire semester teaching Shakespeare, the metaphysical poets, and the romantics before sharing his own poem, If I Must Die, at the very end of class.
I remember him when he read his poem, and it was obvious, like, it talks about the immortality of words, of poetry, of literature. The person who wrote this poem, he dies, okay, he dies physically, but his influence, his inspiration, his ideas, his thoughts, his art remains forever.
El-Hissi sends me these memories in voice notes from a hospital in Jordan. Shortly after the start of the war, El-Hissi was diagnosed with leukemia. He spent weeks under bombardment in Gaza, losing 14 members of his family in one Israeli strike on October 17th. He was only able to leave Gaza because his mother is Ukrainian and he has a foreign passport. Once in Jordan, El-Hissi could only stay in touch with his family through text messages and voice notes, sent only when they could find reception. At one point, as bombs fell overhead, his older brother sent a recording that he thought would be his last.
And it was like about 40 minute voice note that talked about how he faced a lot of death possibilities, that he was about to die, that he went to search for signals or connection to try to call us, to try to call me. But all that he found was death.
In Gaza these past months, the idea of your words continuing to live if your body is gone have taken on new meanings. On a hospital whiteboard at Al-Auda Hospital, a surgeon named Dr. Mahmoud Abu Nujaila left a message.
Whoever stays until the end will tell the story. We did what we could. Remember us.
According to Doctors Without Borders, Abu Nujaila was killed in an airstrike 1 month later, alongside his colleagues.
People only pay attention to Gaza when there's violence. When there's terrible tragedy, that's when you see people pay attention.
U.S. activist Pam Bailey says that this idea of telling the story of individual people was behind the inspiration for We Are Not Numbers, an initiative she co-founded with Dr. Refaat in 2015. The project pairs young Palestinian writers with internationally based mentors.
And we actually have three of our writers who have gone missing. You know, we don't know if they're alive or dead. You know, we had some writers who have been killed along with Rifat.
Dr. Rifat was accused of anti-Semitism for some of his views. In a BBC interview shortly after October 7th, he compared Hamas's attack to the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising, when Jews in occupied Poland rose up unsuccessfully against the Nazis. But he remains an inspiration for his students and supporters. In between cancer treatments in Jordan, his former student Khalid al-Hissi has continued to write.
His poem, If I Must Die, that this is our mission, that we have to continue. We have to complete his mission, not to stop by any means.
For The World, I'm Dari Buscarin.
St. Louis is home to a growing African community. There are so many families that services at one church are now held in Swahili and French. It helps African immigrants build community and feel connected to their roots. Andrea Henderson of St. Louis Public Radio brings us this story of the season.
It's the first Sunday of the Advent season at St. Norbert Catholic Church in Florissant, and about 20 African men and women are singing gospels in Swahili. The church holds Mass on the first Sunday of each month for African immigrants who speak the language. It also holds French services every third Sunday. There are about 50 African families clapping, vivaciously moving their bodies, and singing along to the beat of the African drum. Just about everyone at the service is part of the St. Louis International African Catholic Community Organization. They come to Mass to celebrate their culture with other Africans while practicing their faith. That's Father Anthony Kitima. He's a priest from Kenya who's studying at St. Louis University and initiates the Swahili Mass.
We want them to nourish this kind of faith that they come with. They are now immigrants here in America, but want them now to kind of not forget where they came from, their roots.
The Swahili Mass is one of a kind in the region. He says the African Catholic Organization helps Tanzanians, Ethiopians, Ugandans, and more feel welcome in St. Louis. Diana Donovan, who's from Kenya, is the president of the organization.
When I moved here in 2013, I was the only black person in my parish for many years. But now, just having this community has helped me because I know even if I'm at my parish, you know, for certain weeks, I will definitely be here with the rest of people who share the same values, the same cultures, the same languages as me.
St. Norbert embraced Swahili cultural religious traditions, including dancing behind the priest during his procession. Caroline Mugundi of Kenya has been singing in the Swahili choir since 2018. She says many days she's stressed, but her heart swells with joy when she lifts her voice for God in her native language.
Swahili is our national language and English, so that's why I enjoy. I can be able to understand better when I listen to Swahili Mass. I feel that I'm at home.
For The World, I'm Andrea Henderson.
More stories from around the globe still coming your way this hour. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. The parliament in Spain will soon vote on a bill to grant amnesty to hundreds of Catalan separatists. The region of Catalonia in northeastern Spain tried unsuccessfully to break away in 2017. Some of its leaders were jailed, others fled the country. The reason for this move from persecution to pardons? This fall, Prime Minister Pedro Sanchez needed the votes of the pro-independence parties in order to form his government. After Parliament's announcement of the amnesty bill, huge nationwide protests followed. But as The World's Jerry Haddon reports from Barcelona, amnesties in Spain are nothing new.
What do you get when you mix Christmas with politics in Spain this year? Among other things, a classic carol turned protest song. Whoever hates the homeland must go, sings a group called Los Meconios in this new Facebook video. You can't negotiate with coup leaders, it continues. You can't forgive a traitor. No se perdona quien nos traicionó. The lyrics refer to Prime Minister Sanchez and his promise to forgive Catalan leaders their separatist sins. The online tune has attracted tens of thousands of people, Weekly street protests have too. Several thousand people came out for this recent anti-amnesty march in Barcelona.
Si yo aparco mal, yo, a mí me multan y pago.
Local resident Africa Poyatos was there with friends. She said Sanchez was dividing the nation, creating a class above the law. When I get a parking ticket, she says, I pay it. It's the same for Carlos Puigdemont. He must pay. He's a fugitive from justice, she says. Puigdemont was president of Spain's Catalonia region in 2017. He's the one who stood up and said,
el mandat del poble que Catalunya
the people have spoken. Catalonia has voted to become an independent republic. Before the celebrations died down, Puigdemont had fled for Brussels, where he's been fighting extradition since. If Spain's amnesty law passes, he'd be free to return. But for Spain's political right, he's public enemy number one, along with his Socialist Party abettors. The leader of the far-right Vox Party, Santiago Abascal, recently said Spaniards are going to want Prime Minister Sanchez strung up by his feet. That violent rhetoric created its own scandal, but soon after, Vox Party Secretary Ignacio Garriga brushed off the criticism.
El señor Abascal ha recordado
Mr. Abascal was simply referencing the fate of many Spanish dictators, he said. Some might call it hate speech, but it's not, he said. It's history. But Spain's history is actually replete with amnesties. At least 30 over the last two centuries, says Felix Badia. He's a senior editor at the Barcelona daily La Vanguardia. He says clemency has come from the left, the right, and everywhere in between, starting with kings.
En el siglo XIX, prácticamente cuando llegaba un nuevo rey,
throughout the 19th century, he says, each time a new monarch was crowned, he'd offer general pardons, absolving thousands of people at once, from debtors to pickpockets. In this period, Spain averaged more amnesties than its European neighbors, Badia says, because the country was caught up in nearly constant political upheaval. We had three civil wars in the 19th century, he says, a war against France, then the civil war of the 1930s. We've gone from dictatorships to monarchies to republics. When things are that unstable, in order to calm the chaos, he says, amnesties become a necessity. Dictators have freed jailed generals. Presidents have pardoned insurrectionists. There have been amnesties for financial crimes. The most famous of all came in 1977 after the death of the dictator General Francisco Franco. It gave blanket immunity from prosecution to Franco's enforcers and the dissidents who stood against him. It's the pact, Badia says, that made Spain's current democracy possible.
Eso se vende como la reconciliación nacional, como
it was sold as national reconciliation, he says, a way to close the wounds of the dictatorship and the war. But at the end of the day, he says, it was basically a transaction, as all major amnesties are. I don't come after you, he says, and you don't come after me. In its day, this amnesty, known as the Pact of Forgetting, was embraced by just about everyone. Except for a small group of civil guardsmen who tried to stage a coup in 1981. They stormed a stunned parliament, but then Spanish King Juan Carlos intervened and the coup collapsed. Since then, Spain's democracy has been stable. No one's expecting a coup attempt now, despite what Badia calls the hyperbolic rhetoric from Spain's conservatives, though the proposed amnesty for the Catalan separatists is more contentious compared to earlier ones, he says, because not everyone benefits, least of all Spain's conservatives.
Los partidos políticos independentistas ganan.
The Catalan Independence Party wins, Badia says. The socialists as well. But Spain's right gets nothing out of this deal. And since one sector of society sees zero benefit, he says, even finds itself sidelined, the controversy has only grown. As have the protests. And adding to the fire, Catalan separatists show no signs of remorse, even though polls suggest most Catalans want to stay in Spain. In fact, some separatists are calling for yet another push for independence. With amnesty within reach, they're only feeling emboldened. For The World, I'm Jerry Haddon in Barcelona.
It was the deadliest mass shooting in the history of the Czech Republic, and a week on, the mourning and soul-searching have not dissipated. Since last Thursday, people have gathered outside the university, lighting candles and holding vigil. One of those gathered there last week, Christoff Unger, said friends at the school are reeling.
And they have just been really traumatized by the shooting there.
A week ago, a lone gunman entered Charles University in the heart of Prague and opened fire, leaving 14 people dead and dozens injured. The 24-year-old shooter was a master's student at the university. He killed himself after being surrounded by police. It's something that is all too familiar for people here in the U.S. The Czech Republic has only recently enshrined the right to bear arms in its constitution. To learn more, we turn to Ian Willoughby, who's a journalist based in Prague. So a week later, Ian, can you just describe the mood in Prague after this horrific event? The people you meet, what are you hearing and seeing?
Well, as you can imagine, Marco, it's very somber here in Prague a week after the shootings. There have been a constant stream of people at those memorials. I was there yesterday and there were still people gathered there. Also, there has been attention paid to the other two victims of this killer, because a week previous to the shootings at the university, he killed a man in the woods near Prague and the two-month-old daughter of this man. That crime had horrified the country previously, and it later transpired that the same killer was behind both those killings.
Really horrible news for the Czech Republic. The police said the shooter owned legally purchased firearms. That right to bear arms is embedded in the Czech Constitution. What does that look like, though, when it comes to actually purchasing firearms?
Well, the Czech Republic is seen as one of the most liberal countries in Europe when it comes to gun ownership. I myself am from Ireland, and when I first moved here, I was shocked at the prevalence of guns. You'd be aware that people were carrying guns, say, in their briefcases or whatever. To get a gun here, you have to be resident of this country, you have to be over 21. Also, you have to have a letter from your doctor saying you're fit to own a weapon. The doctor can insist on you undergoing a psychological test, but that's at their own discretion. You also have to undergo a practical test in handling a gun and prove that you have no criminal record. Also, the police can now take away somebody's weapon if they suspect that the person has mental health issues. But all told here, it is relatively easy to get weapons.
Yeah, interesting guardrails, just thinking about the United States. In the U.S., of course, gun rights go back to the founding of the country. The story is different, though, in the Czech Republic, right? What is the history there?
Well, in the Czech Republic, under the Nazis, having a gun was a capital offense. Under communism, which was here for 40 years, from 1948 to 89, it was virtually impossible for a private citizen to own a gun except for hunting purposes. And even in those years, in the communist years, owning a typewriter, you had to have it registered with the authorities. There was extreme control. But after 1989, with the return to democracy here, there was an explosion in gun sales. Czechs really had so little liberty that when freedom came, they demanded as much as possible, and they really insist on having personal freedom in a way that you mightn't find in some countries.
A mass shooting like the one at the university last week is one thing, obviously really tragic. Generally, though, how common is gun violence in the Czech Republic? Like, are there daily shootings of individuals or gang violence?
There is gun violence here. The latest figures, or the most recent figures for gun deaths in one year, were for 2019, when there were 195 gun deaths in this country. The previous years, there were fewer, 170, 174. You do hear of shootings here, yes, of course, but not mass shootings. The one last week was only the third that has occurred here. Last week's was the most tragic mass shooting we've seen here ever.
In the U.S., as you know, Ian, shootings like this always lead to the raising of the issue of gun control. With this historic shooting in the Czech Republic, are people reassessing that freedom and talking about whether these gun rights are worth it?
Not as much as you might imagine. There really isn't that much discussion about gun law and gun restrictions. Czech leaders have been kind of highlighting the fact that the shooter last week was a lone individual, a deranged individual. There is actually new legislation on gun control going through the Czech Parliament, and it was in that process before last week's events. That new law won't come into effect until 2026. The one thing it won't have, though, is compulsory psychological evaluations, which some people have been saying should be brought in, but there's no plan to do that. And the Minister of the Interior, Vito Rakušan, said after the shootings last week with regard to legislation that there was no way that any legislation could guarantee that such things would never happen.
Are you surprised that this mass shooting has not really sparked a debate about gun control?
I am and I'm not, because the gun lobby here is very strong. When they brought in the right to bear arms, that was only 2 years ago. There are a lot of pro-gun people in this country. And the other side are not organized at all, I would say. Also, for many people, this is really something new. It's the first time in Prague. that anything like this has happened. It's the worst such case. It's the first case at an educational institution. And for many people, it's something they're still kind of digesting. How could that happen here?
As you said, Ian, you're from Ireland and you've lived in the Czech Republic for decades. What is your takeaway from the shooting?
I've been here for 30 years. It's the worst thing by a long distance that's happened here. Definitely in Prague, you know, it's also here, it's really safe. Usually in Ireland, I'm really concerned about my safety just because there's a lot of random violence. Here, I never look over my shoulder. You just feel like totally safe here coming from Ireland or the UK. Although this is still so random in many ways, I don't think it'll make me fearful, even though being in crowded places in the last week, I have been a bit jumpy just because there have been a lot of reports of people threatening copycat killings and all this kind of stuff. They're probably all just keyboard warriors. But yeah, I have been a little bit concerned about my safety for the first time.
We've been speaking with Ian Willoughby. He's a journalist based in Prague, the capital of the Czech Republic, where a lone gunman carried out the worst mass shooting of its kind in the country's history last Thursday. Ian, thank you very much for being with us.
You're very welcome.
As we come to the end of this 50th anniversary year for the sound that emerged from the Bronx in 1973, there's one final thing we must check off, the Planet Hip Hop list. We've heard how hip hop is spread around the globe, but U.S. hip hop artists and producers have also been inspired by sounds from the globe, samples that get dubbed and make their way into some of hip hop's classic tracks. Sometimes the samples are just a few bars of a song from a distant place, but even then, someone had to be digging through some pretty obscure crates to find those hooks. So for the next couple of minutes, a modest survey of global samples in hip hop that maybe flew under your radar. We've got to start with British band The Shadows and their track Apache. Allusions to the Wild West and Western soundtracks popular in Jamaican music, it caught the ear of Jamaican-born DJ Kool Herc, the original hip-hop innovator and impresario, who spun it at those first parties in the Bronx, using a remix version of Apache by the incredible Bongo Band. Another early hip-hop classic dipped into synth rock from Germany and the iconic band Kraftwerk. Kraftwerk's cold and robotic Trans-Europe Express became warm and funky when it underpinned Planet Rock from Afrika Bambaataa and the Soul Sonic Force. Artists often get the nod for finding these obscure samples, but we've also got to pay respect to producers like Timbaland, who simply have a good ear for hot licks. Timbaland heard the beat in Fela Kuti's 1977 song Colonial Mentality, and it became the drum and bass line driving Missy Elliott's 2001 track, What You Gonna Do? Timbaland also had his antenna tuned to sounds from the Egyptian classical back catalog when he came upon this 1957 classic from the great film singer Abdel Halim Hafez, a track titled Hosara. Timbaland sampled that for Jay-Z's hit Big Pimpin' more than 40 years later. International samples in hip-hop? Too many to mention, honestly. There's Eric B. and Rakim sampling Israeli singer Ofrahaza on their 1987 track Paid in Full. Pump up the volume, pump up the volume. Oh, there's a teeny sample of legendary Brazilian guitarist Luiz Bonfá. That runs all the way through The Far Side's Running. One final sample in our survey, a riff we were reminded of when its composer died earlier this year. That progression right there, it's the lead into this banger, the next episode from Dr. Dre and Snoop Dogg. Da, 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 da. It's the one and only Deagle Double G. The original music, though, is the brainchild of the actor and musician David McCallum, the late star of Man from U.N.C.L.E. and later on NCIS. Next Monday's edition of The World, New Year's Day, we'll be taking you through some of our favorite stories and interviews from the 50th anniversary year of hip-hop and how the sound has been embraced around the globe for its ability to say things in music you can't always say in words. Join us for that, Planet Hip Hop, on January 1st. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Secretary of State Antony Blinken, along with other White House officials, were in Mexico City yesterday seeking help to deal with the migrant crisis at the southern U.S. border. Mexican President Andrés Manuel López Obrador said he wants to help, but he also wants to see progress in U.S. relations with Cuba and Venezuela, two places many are choosing to leave. We want to focus on Venezuela, which since 2014 has seen more than 7 million of its residents become migrants. Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro blames the U.S. and punishing economic sanctions for the exodus. David Smild is a professor at Tulane University who has researched and written about Venezuela for 30 years. He joins us from Venezuela's capital, Caracas. We're really interested, David, in the economic conditions in Venezuela that are pushing so many people to leave. Let's start with U.S. sanctions on Venezuela's oil and gas sector. They were lifted in October. What impact has that had on Venezuela?
Well, it hasn't had a big impact so far because what it basically allows is different international oil companies to start investing to try and increase their oil production and exporting. So it'll take a little while for this to have a significant impact. Oil, you know, it's an industry that has to be continuously operative to be functional. And so to get it going again takes years of investment. And so there's got to be more than that. And talking about migration issues, it's got to be more than just sanctions relief, which is underway already.
You're in Caracas right now, as I said. As you look around you, what impact do those sanctions have on Venezuelans' kind of day-to-day lives?
Well, I've been here, you know, off and on for the past 30 years, and so I certainly saw this whole process. And the first thing to remember is that the economic crisis started before the sanctions and was really quite significant from 2015 to 2017. Enormous scarcities and many businesses going under and people losing their jobs and rampant inflation. The financial sanctions that happened in 2017 and the oil sanctions that happened in 2019 had a huge impact on the Venezuelan economy. Before the sanctions, it was largely because of the government's policies and corruption. The sanctions came along and really hit the basic industry, the basic motor of the economy. And from 2020 or so, the liberalization of the economy has sort of counteracted that. You know, a lot of it's dollarized the economy, and so people can at least conserve their wealth and carry out transactions. But still, today, the economy is roughly 20-25% of what it was in 2015. So if you can imagine a 70-80% drop in GDP, as soon as you get out of Caracas, you see really devastating poverty. You know, people that don't have tires for their bicycles and, you know, make tires out of strips of truck tires. And are using horse and buggies. It's just really devastating poverty outside of the capital.
Sitting there in Caracas, what can you tell us about the reasons you're hearing for the thousands of Venezuelans who have left the country?
Well, you know, about half of those or over half of those are people that have migrated before to Colombia, Peru, Ecuador, and may have been there for months or a couple of years and don't have their basic necessities met. And so they're thinking, well, what next? Do I want to go back to Venezuela where it looks like, you know, there's still not a functioning democracy and I don't trust the government? or do I want to try and have a better life in the United States? And most of them opt for the latter. There is this economic situation with sanctions, but behind all of this is the fact that Venezuela is not a democracy. People know that the Maduro government has strong control of the electoral institutions, all the basic institutions of the country, and that there's not likely to be a free and fair election in 2024. But likely, you know, Maduro is probably here to stay. And so I think a lot of people think that they need to, you know, head north.
Does President Maduro blame the U.S. and the Biden administration for the economic conditions in Venezuela?
Oh, absolutely. Even when the U.S. had nothing to do with the economic conditions, there were no relevant sanctions at all. And so since 2017, 2019, he has had a good argument, and he's been able to say, you know, this is because of the sanctions. And so it's a little bit difficult to have a good relationship with Venezuela, you know, and of course the United States tends to sort of forget its role in the region over the decades and centuries. But I think, you know, there's a pretty good team in the National Security Council that is working in Venezuela and that knows the region. And little by little, my Maduro government, I think there's some exhaustion on all sides, and people want to get out from under the current status quo. The Maduro government wants to have some international recognition. They want to have an election that's recognized by the U.S. and other countries and get out from under these sanctions. And the U.S., especially after the Russian invasion of Ukraine, is thinking about energy security and is thinking about wanting Venezuela to stay as part of sort of the Western Hemisphere and not have Russia and China as its main point of reference. And so I think there's a real desire on all sides to get out from under this problem. And so sometimes that pragmatism can, you know, trump the very different sort of ideological stances of the U.S. and the Venezuelan government.
David Smild is a professor at Tulane University who has researched and written about Venezuela for 30 years. He joined us from Venezuela's capital, Caracas. Great to chat. Thanks very much, David.
Thank you.
South Africans are in mourning today over the sudden death of Mbongani Ngama. He came to the world's attention in 1988 with the Broadway musical Sarafina. It's a story of a young black schoolgirl in an apartheid-era black township in South Africa. She leads a student protest, much like the historic Soweto uprising in June 1976. Ngama lived that history and also chronicled black South African life under the apartheid regime. Years before Sarafina put him in the spotlight, Ngama had co-written the award-winning play Wolza Albert. Here's a small taste.
One basi. Anything basi. Garden boy, cleaner, car wash, always smiling basi. Have you got work for me basi? Dog
spitting. Ngama stood above other black playwrights of his generation. He was grateful and proud for having grown up a poor farm kid and then coming of age in an all-black township. He spoke this year with South African podcaster David Mashabela.
I have the best of both worlds. I grew up in the rural areas. I also grew up in the township. Combine these two things and bring them to the theater world. You are never going to match me because you don't have that experience of growing up in rural life.
Ngama's talent brought him into elite cultural and political circles. A close friend of Nelson Mandela, he tells a story about visiting Mandela's then-wife, Winnie. It was the early 1980s. Her husband was in prison. Apartheid's brutality was only growing. In that podcast, Ngama recalled that Winnie shared her worst fears with him about South Africa's future.
I remember I drove out of her house thinking about what she had just said, and then I began to see young children in school uniform running and singing. And the song that came to my mind was Freedom is coming tomorrow.
Freedom is coming tomorrow. Get ready and prepare for your freedom.
Music there composed by playwright Mbongani Ngama, who died yesterday in a car crash at the age of 68. We remember him along with many in South Africa and around the globe. The World comes to you every weekday from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston and the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. You can find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Marco Werman. Be safe, stay strong, and as always, thanks for listening. Before we go, Marco here with a quick reminder. Time is running out to donate to our fundraiser and help us unlock a $67,000 matching gift. If you've been meaning to donate but haven't yet, We need you to step up now. Your gift will help sustain our newsroom into 2023. Learn more and donate at theworld.org/give.